I am Carlisle Holte, retired from the Religion Department of St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, as of May 31st, and so far I have found nothing to complain about in retirement. And I congratulate those of you who, whether early or later, retired and began to live it up in the way that only retired people can. Somewhere along the way, I heard about an organization of retired, and there must be a better word for that too, it certainly isn't senior citizens, but they called their group Not Done Yet. And I think that's the kind of people that come here, especially. Now, I try to remember certain things as I start. I'll get on to my topic. But I tend to forget that some of you might take time to read some of the materials that we are talking about. At my last visit and check in the bookstore, there were copies of the two books. Well, the one that I am sort of finishing up with today, I've been here for a week and a half now, and I shall be making reference to this book by a contemporary Japanese woman, poet, and writer of fiction, Ayako Miura, M-I-U-R-A, and the title is The Wind is Howling. If you become very interested in it and don't find a copy in the bookstore, it is published by the InterVarsity Press, and you might find it in a religious bookstore. You will find this and the second book, Dag Hammarskjöld's Markings, on the reserve shelf in the library, which is just down the central corridor, and I think it's the second door, the sort of lending library part. On a shelf against the north window are books that are being currently used by the various lecturers at Holden. You may also notice that on the table as you come in, there is a considerable rack of Lewis books. Those still have their library cards in them, and like the other books on the shelves there, you may borrow them for your stay here, take them out and read them. The reserve books are there to be read in the room, put back so that somebody else may come along in half an hour and read them. It isn't certainly at all necessary to read or have read these books. It's an advantage, and it's not a matter of trying to sell you on reading a great deal of Lewis or reading Miura or of Hammarskjöld for that matter, but I hope to give you, even in this 1 hour, which may be the one opportunity that you have to hear about God and faith in autobiography, a sense of some values for both spiritual consideration, if we want to make the distinction, and religious theological insights through the reading of autobiographies. Now, I would not put every single religious autobiography in a desirable category. I have made a selection. I have taught this course formally at St. Olaf for a good number of years, and the three books that I submit to Holden people for consideration are three out of the six autobiographies that I deal with there, which says I think that they have some extra quality. They do tend to tell about a conversion experience, as in the first book I dealt with, the first part of last week, C.S. Lewis's spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy. In that, Lewis says in his introduction that he will tell, at the request of many people, how he moved from atheism to Christianity. There is no such special introduction to Miura's writing, but in my first session, two sessions ago, with The Wind is Howling, I pointed out that the problem that afflicted Ayaka Mayura, spiritually at the start, was the absolute lack of meaning in her life. That has a special name. It is nothingness in English. It is nihilism, N-I-H-I-L-I-S-M, directly borrowed from the Latin. Sometimes you will hear theologians or philosophers pronounce it nihilism, but my old Latin teachers at college would squirm if they heard that I misused the pronunciation they taught me so badly. But Ayako says at the outset that she could find no meaning in life. To add to her problem was the fact that as she begins the story, she is speaking out of a defeated Japan, directly post-World War II, when the religious values, the confidence in the emperor to lead them and save them, had been utterly destroyed, and the nation was submitted to an ignominious, shameful, total surrender. There are some things to keep in mind. Since I'm going to speak a little bit more about Ayako, I think we want to appreciate a couple of things in the background of reading such an account. She was Japanese, and one of the elements that I think we are, in general, quite aware of is that the Japanese save face. They are... It shows more that they resent being put down. Northern Europeans probably, when they are embarrassed or put down in some way, can carry it off. And probably, if they have grace enough, they can forget about it. But you see, the nation Japan, which had such great goals, was absolutely destroyed by the defeat. It was not simply... atomic bomb, it was the whole progression of the war. Some of you people probably know that very intimately. Having gone along first with great success and even defeating China and the islands of the Pacific, little by little, they are pushed back again into the confines of their own little land. The second element is not so obvious, but it is that Ayako Mayura came out of some rather limited contact and commitment, mainly a cultural commitment, to Buddhism. And this, too, now is about to be replaced, as the story progresses, with the Christian faith. And those are two theologies, two religious viewpoints that are worlds apart. So while you don't get a sense of the tremendous upheaval, you must realize that for her and for others of the Oriental world, it is not like a Westerner whose roots probably go back to the Christian faith, coming back into the faith. There's something revolutionary, and it is no wonder that progress in the Oriental world is much slower comparatively. We've heard reports, and we've seen pictures and stories about a Chinese Christian church that is coming up out of the ashes, so to speak. But even so, the proportion of Christians in China is a very tiny percentage of that vast, uncountable population. Now, this is not meant to be pessimistic, but we must appreciate this and recognize that the transformation to seeing in the Christian faith a meaning for her life, though it's not made tremendously dramatic always, is a great change. Just a word about the title, because titles are important. Her book is called The Wind is Howling. And that doesn't ring any associative bells for us, although it should. It comes from a hymn translated into Japanese by Japanese Christians, and it's still a familiar hymn, although it has been sort of shelved for a long time. In the New Standard hymn books, you may not find it, but it is, Jesus, lover of my soul, let me to thy bosom fly, while the nearer waters roll, while the tempest still is high. Now, for some reason, I suppose that wouldn't have said much more. We've had first the translation into Japanese, and then the literal translation from the Japanese, so we come out not with the title, While the Tempest Still is High, but The Wind is Howling. And I call attention, too, with apologies to those who believe you should read a book through to the end before you know how it ends, that the last line of this book is a happy ending. And with a sort of fastidious writer's hand, Ayako says, after her marriage, after a sort of settling of her religious perspective, it was a beautiful, warm day. There was not a trace of wind. Some of the footnotes say that for the Japanese, there is very intimate reaction between the Japanese and the weather. And I suppose we manifest a little bit of that. I think the primary reaction to the weather around here is, my, it's cold. You know? And then when the sun is out, we react to that. But the nuances. And there are not too many of us who say, oh, I like to get out in a good, gusty wind with the rain driving. The first thing I think about is that when it even drizzles, the rain all seems to land on my glasses and I don't have a Kleenex around. Now, I can't recap all of what we talked about, but there is a good deal of the theme of suffering in Mayura's story, because she was for a long time a tuberculosis patient. And we have gone through naming various aspects of suffering. In the ultimate of her accepting the Christian faith, which comes after a great deal of discussion, after attending services, studying the Bible, and being helped very much, she comes to a point where it is not just a matter of being a nice, quiet member of a congregation, but a special kind of commitment. Along the way, her movement toward the Christian faith has been accelerated by devout, dedicated Christian people. There are lay Japanese Christians, some who have their own work and plenty of headaches about that, who manifested their concern for her by bringing her food, stopping to read, pray with her. There are people of some means who have shared with her because her confinement with illness and her inability to work put a lot of financial strain on an already impoverished family. But there's one person in particular who comes on the scene and can give us sort of a bridging over here. He was also a tubercular man. His name was Tadashi Maekawa, and he was a Christian. He and Ayako knew each other from way back, and he sort of starts out with that. There is not an immediate romantic cast to this. And I want to get right on to where Tadashi, who, as I say, is tubercular, he's had some study in medicine, and seems to have not a fatalistic, but a realistic concept of the shortness of life that's going to be his. It is a sort of peculiar situation. He looks healthy, but he coughs blood. No, he's quite heavy. And Ayako is thin as a rail. But he knows. This is deception. And he tells her that he has decided to live the rest of his life for her. And primarily that means that he wants to help her to the Christian faith. Søren Kierkegaard, the philosopher, talks about a midwife, the faith. And in a sense, that is what Tadashi will be. Now, it doesn't mean that he's always there hounding her, but it does say that this is his passion. And it moves her because she realizes that there is a peculiar kind of love here. She has met men who have propositioned her, who want to sleep with her, men who would like to marry her. So they have a wife and probably have children. That gets to be pretty much an impossibility in her unhealthy condition. But Tadashi is different from all of these. He loves her for herself alone. He will gain nothing from her conversion. And he is tremendously distressed at how slowly she progresses. And yet, he does not give up. And it is this aspect of a love that will not let me go, of a life lived for somebody else, that more and more, in the latter part of the book, keeps coming in. Now, I do have to try to move on here and pick up a couple of references. Let's see here. See, I fully expect the lights will go out any time, which really spooks you.
You're not trying to run a slide projector.
I do have a flashlight here, but it may not help too much. Here is a sample of her reflective writing on a period after Mayakawa has died. And she's just gone into a sort of welter of grief over him, and at the same time she is physically very badly off. But here's what she says: "At the same time, I at last began to realize how rebellious my own faith had been. I believed in God, or rather I thought I did, but what did believing really mean in my case? I had been very angry when Tadashi Mayakawa had died, and afterwards I had often complained, 'God, why did you call Tadashi-san without taking my life too? Or God, wouldn't a wonderful person like Tadashi-san still have been of use in this world? Wouldn't it have been better for him to live instead of a worthless person like me?' I'd openly voiced my dissatisfaction to God and had gone on complaining to him." Then later on here, I guess I've got to turn another page. "Suddenly I realized how I was thinking. It appalled me. Wasn't I supposed to be living as Tadashi Mayakawa had wanted to? If I had taken over his life, shouldn't I be living it with determination? Shouldn't I expect to get well again along with the other sick friends God had given me? I pulled myself up. Nothing would come from being engrossed in my own grief. No, my own life was withering away. Once the period of mourning ended on May 2nd, I decided to receive all those who came to visit me. For a whole year, I had never slept before 1:14 a.m., the time when he had died." That sounds pretty fishy. Artificial programming. This was wrong, and at last I knew it. From that point on, she begins to open up more. She's shown some mild breakthroughs, helping out a teenage girl with tuberculosis who had tried to commit suicide and being a friend to her. But basically, she has this oppressive lassitude. Nothing still quite matters, and she can't really see what to do. Well, things are limited, but she does discover that she can mail out some religious literature to people, and when they write back, she can write notes to them, probably write one note and rest, and write another and rest, this sort of thing. But the topic I introduced yesterday was living for others, and we did some inquiry into sort of what this meant. I have a notation here to show that the models for this kind of a life are not given just by recently converted or recently awakened people. There's nothing said ever about the rest of Ayako's family becoming Christian. But her father worked in his older age, I don't know exactly how old he was, uncomplainingly to take care of her and a fairly large family. And the mother slaved away, quite literally. Some of the time, at least, Ayako was a patient at home, and that meant a lot of extra care. it meant, as time went on, that there were visitors that came. And the mother uncomplainingly said, you know, when at difficult time, when people come around at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and they stay until 5:15, what do you do? Do you begin to rattle pots and pans in the kitchen? You can hardly say, don't you have a home? But Ayako's mother would graciously invite these visitors, friends of her daughters, to stay for a meal. And the striking thing to me, this is sort of in the pattern. We'd say it's, as Rich said today, it's mannerly. But she would go and visit. She'd walk out to visit personally friends of Ayako's because Ayako couldn't make it. That sounds like a strange thing to do. But it was more than just delivering a note saying, I know Ayako's thinking about you, chat a while, and bring Ayako's greetings and bring the message back again. Living for somebody else. It's not the fullness, but it is there. Now, this is not a Bible study, but there are some key passages. And I got gremlins here. Things get lost. Murphy's Law. One passage that I haven't touched down on before in Romans 14:7. None of us lives to himself, and none of us dies to himself. If we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end Christ died and lived again, that he might be Lord both of the dead and of the living. And particularly verse 7. None of us lives to himself. None of us dies to himself. That was really the consciousness that came through to Ayako there about the time, a year after Tadashi had died. What was I doing? Just thinking about myself. And really holding people at a distance and saying, oh, I can't do anything and I'm worthless and all that sort of drivel. Forgetting that there is the possibility of living for others. Now, I'm going to move into something that seems to be rather a far cry from the specifics of The Wind is Howling, because I would like to get a little bit better label to name, as some of you heard Susan doing in Bible study a day or so ago. Name the darkness. I want to name this living for others. And to do that, there is this idea of co-inherent life that I think has been developed and really quite concretely set out by a very close friend of C.S. Lewis's. Now, that should commend him. The man's name is Charles Williams. And if you prowl around in the bookstore, you will see that there is one whole shelf of Charles Williams books, a good deal of fiction. And a copy of this little book of church history, from which I'll be looking or quoting in a little while, that's called The Descent of the Dove, History of the Holy Spirit and the Church. Charles Williams gets a very fine press from those who knew him. Here in a study of his literature, one of the formal studies, literary type, by Alice Hadford, there is this significant paragraph with which we'll start. Williams was not a very healthy person, and so when Second World War came along, although he was of an age where he might have been drafted for some kind of duty, they simply said, you won't be any good. And he went on. He was basically sort of grinding out a life and living for himself and his wife and a son as an editor for for Oxford University Press. Now, that was prestigious, but it was also demanding, and it's quite fabulous that along with that he was able to write as much as he did. You don't know what Rich Kammerer does, but he happens to live up in Chalet 9, where we have our room above him, and we came in rather late one evening. He's still working, and said, "You know, aren't you going to bed?" Well, he probably get to bed about 4 or 5, and he's up for breakfast at 7, and well, what about a nap during the day? Well, probably 3/4 of an hour. I said, "You do even better than Thomas Edison, who had the reputation, you know, for hardly sleeping." But I read somewhere that Edison would lie down on the bench and catch cat naps every so often. Well, here is a man who's not well, who holds down a job and writes like fury, and he did die, we would say, young, to the grief of his good friends. Point here is, I don't need to elaborate it so much, is that he did not go to Second World War. He was not an air raid warden or something like that. And here are some of his reflections. It was in meditation on war and his friends that he first began to approach the idea that his life was involved in the lives of all other people, and not only of people he had chosen to love and live with. Now, in the first place, we have here an expansion of this idea of living for somebody else. The Dashi said, "I will live for you, Ayako." Ayako's mother said, "I live for you, for my other children, for my husband, for my immediate circle." But there is this enlargement that comes out of a spiritual depth, as I have noticed it in reading a good deal about Charles Williams. His life is involved in the lives of all other people. He recognized that he benefited from the effort and pains endured by others far from him, and not at the time concerned with or for him. He saw that pains and effort could and would be inflicted within himself, which would be part of the life of the effort and pains of those others. This is the beginning of coherence, the main concept of all his thought. Now, in some ways, it's rather hard to handle that. He was thinking of people that he knew, friends of his, very good friends, who had been killed in the war. I can do that too, and I have had contact with a newly made friend, married to an old friend from college, who's told me of some of his war experiences in convoy across the Atlantic, when 20% or more of the ships in convoy would go down, and there was no stopping the convoy. I was reminded of one young man that I knew from college, about whom I heard that his ship had gone down in the North Atlantic. What convoy? Who knows? And I did not go. I was exempt as already a theological student. My vision already then was okay, but nothing great when they were still fussing about having two good eyes that would correct up to 20/20. Well, forget it, you know. And there's a peculiar sense that there was a dying for me by these people. Now, the reason that you get to be a little cautious about this is that we've had Vietnam, and we can't say, too many of us can't say, they died in Vietnam for us, which complicates things. And it's not specifically those who die in war, but those who give themselves that William sees. And there's coherence. Now, I come to this little book with an introduction by noted British poet W. H. Auden, who knew Charles Williams at first hand and had read and admired his work. And he comes to the conclusion that this idea of coherence is basic to understanding Charles Williams. And here there is one phrase, and I want you to listen carefully to it, because I want you to talk just a little bit about it with me very soon. The doctrine might be briefly summarized as follows. The first law of the spiritual universe, the real city, is nobody can carry his or her own burden. He or she only can, therefore he or she must, carry someone else's. Now, that's the rather astonishing and I think disturbing thing that we see in Williams, and it is not that far away from what we read in Eocomira. But I think it bears some kind of conversation, and really there are sort of three factors here. No one can carry his or her own burden. Two, we can carry the burden of others. Three, put them together. No one can carry his or her own burden. We can carry the burden of others. So, don't feel you have to say, oh, that's right, I never thought of that before, but that's right. Of course, that won't give us a good discussion, but it'll be too artificial. What do you hear here? We cannot carry our own burdens, but we can carry burdens of others. And that, William says, is a sort of a cosmic law.
Well, I'm glad it's a cosmic law, because people that drive you nuts with their burdens, maybe then we can feel better by helping carry them and using the Lord to help us both.
Can we carry part of our own burden?
I'll just let it come here. It's not my job to see, on a scale of 10. But that's something. I think we're thinking that way. Can we carry part? Somebody else.
No man is an island.
No man is an island. Okay. That's good poetry. Ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. When somebody dies, there's something of us, whether we know them or not.
Could a person that totally took care of his own burdens have time for anyone else?
Now, here's sort of the practical side. That's not a funny program piece going on. That's the staff. And they, I was warned before that when they meet, they'd be over there and they laugh a lot. And I can talk over them. Yeah, this is something that we do think about. It's wrestling with the idea of selfishness, self-centeredness.
I always thought I could take pride in bearing my own burdens and not asking anyone else to help bear them for me. One of our ministers pointed out at one time that you're selfish to think that way. You should give others the privilege of helping you bear your burdens and help them bear theirs. I never thought of it that way. I thought, I have to be strong. I have to bear my burdens. I don't want to bother anyone else with my burdens. And then when it was pointed out that was a selfish attitude.
Now that's a switcheroo, isn't it?
Thinking, well, maybe I should let someone else help bear mine and also help bear theirs.
There's a Bible passage on the left from bear one another's burdens and fulfill the law, right?
So it's in the biblical context. I think, as you were saying, this gets to be sort of a matter of our integrity and probably something of an American fierce independence. And that's why I tie it in so easily with this Japanese outlook, because there is that independence and that sense of not wanting to owe somebody else for a favor. So in the Japanese culture, if somebody does a favor for you, you should repay. And as I sort of parody it, with just a little bit more. Which, gets to be a kind of a contest. There are some people who give you an extravagant gift, and, the next time, you can't give them a dollar and a quarter book.
Well, even in the Bible, they had the Good Samaritan. He was helping carry someone else's burden.
Yeah.
What kind of burdens do we carry? Are they mostly mental and psychological rather than physical? If they are, then carrying somebody else's would take your mind off your own. But are there burdens that nobody can carry for you? You indicate maybe not.
This is partly why as we're going along, we were trying to name kinds of suffering. And, of course, you touch on some here, a mental, physical. We're thinking about sufferings. Not so much really involved here immediately with the material. That would be sort of diversionary, although it's there. I think we all see fit, if we have children, if they are growing up and getting established, to slip them a little extra money or make them a temporary loan so they can buy that house or ease them over the rough spots, or others too. So that's not excluded. But there's that vast range of private, personal, human suffering that I think we should look at first, and doesn't say that the big issues in the world are negligible. We're hearing enough about those, and I think some people say we're getting a bad conscience about them. I want to give another bad conscience where I say, do we know about carrying somebody else's burden? Are we willing to take that? And the corollary, of course, is, at least as Williams puts it, that we have to let somebody carry ours. And that's a hang-up too, isn't it?
Don't you think some people find it hard to expose their burdens to someone else?
How many people find it difficult to give their burdens to Christ, and on the other hand, find it difficult to accept forgiveness, to do away with the guilt, and thereby getting rid of some of the burdens in our lives?
That's of the same character, and it's analogous. If it's a burden of guilt, well, another old hymn, take it to the Lord in prayer. And we hear about pure grace, free grace, and yet we also hear that people want to do something for their own salvation. Either they want to sort of get themselves revved up to receive God, or they want to help God. And it's an offensive thing to be told that salvation is the total work of God. Grace, free grace, is really awfully hard to accept. Yes?
I believe that the burdens may be either great or small, probably two. I think it's an interesting observation about the human mind. Sometimes you carry the burden of problem for a long time and judge it, and finding that how quickly the mind will work around and pass on something else to worry about. I mean, Stanley Jones, one of the mentioned that once before. I think we've seen it work in our lives. Human mind is unique with one burden, has a tendency perhaps to begin to worry about something else.
Well, we sort of get attached to our burdens, too. Yes, I see a hand back there.
Well, my question is, though, when you are looking for someone to help you bear your burden, aren't the ones that you look for the one who have made peace with their own burden? Who's going to most help the one who just had a mastectomy, but somebody who's been through it? Who's most going to help the grieving, but somebody who is able to bring them their experience and how they have dealt with that and how they have found God to help them deal with it?
And I think that's, there's a double element there in what you're saying, that the kind of help that each one of us is fitted to make may be that that we have learned about for ourselves through kind of bitter experience. When we are in a community of affliction of a certain kind, as you mentioned, a person who's had a certain operation, a person who has had a bout with cancer, the person who has a handicap. And that says that we're not told to go just running around to everybody looking for something to do for them. But Williams, too, doesn't specify who you're going to help. It just says, be open to it. There's an old phrase that's a parody of the Christian who just sort of is full of enthusiasm, but no direction. And it said, he jumped on his horse and rode off in all directions. And I remember how our seminary president, in a day when the president was also the sort of chief counselor, I don't know what all offices he had, he also came around to see that the janitor did his job. But there was a rather strange fellow who had lots of ideas, and his ideas sort of carried him out of the classroom and the academic work a good deal. Well, he was called in by the president for a little consultation, and the president sort of made a list of problems this young man had posed, and his final word, as I heard, and I was not the mouse in the corner, but he said, young man, I suggest that you take some of the feathers out of your tail and put them in your wings. Instead of going off half-cocked and all kinds of things, you know, develop some strength. Well, that's one of the first things. And then, and here I think is, if you want it, the moral, the ultimate moral of this principle, let yourself be freed up to give without antagonizing the recipient. And here's something of the problem. There is a way, a very heavy-handed way of helping that makes the recipient want to spit in your eye and makes it very resentful. This is not a political soapbox here, but isn't this something of what we do as a community? When we inflict on the recipients of, help, whether it's ADC help or food stamps, something that says, well, of course, we don't need this, but you poor souls, now we'll help you. It's been a way in which we have come with the gospel with such arrogance and with so much of our own additions to the gospel that it's a miracle that we ever had any converts buy in. You know, they used to jest about how the missionaries were primarily concerned about teaching the barbarians to bathe, so they brought soap, and to cover their bodies, so they brought women Mother Hubbards and trained men to dress properly. And in their culture, there was not the kind of sensitivity we had. And you know how absurdly wild we can go. Just look at all the commercials for soaps and deodorants. We are the rottenest, stinkingest, smelliest people on earth, if you were to look at our commercials anywhere. And then we tell the rest of the world that they'd better shape up. Yes?
Ted lost me. How are you equating arrogance with helping people by means of food stamps or ADC, and how does this relate to helping someone bear their burdens? You're speaking of government programs to help persons in social justice and equity when they need help.
Well, I'm saying that for many people, the taxpayers, they're being very smug about this and can't make it a free gift. I'm saying also that in any kind of helping, it's not an ego trip for the giver. It's free. The model is Christ freely gave for us. We freely give. But I'm simply trying to point up that there's a temptation to want to score points by this, by our giving. And at least Williams, in his way of interpreting, is saying that we'd better be humble about this. If we are helping somebody, it's because we have the ability to help. If we are stronger, that's not something that we necessarily worked up because we tried out for the Olympics. It's a healthy body and so on. If we Well, if we enjoy better economic status and a lot of people in the world, there are a lot of elements there that are not just a matter of our industry. And that's what sort of opened up this whole can of worms of our ability to say, no doubt we are the people, and you ought to be grateful that I'm willing to help you, because
the gift without the giver is bare.
The gift without the giver is bare. But it is a very peculiar idea, and I just project it, and I just soon have you lose a little sleep tonight, or if you don't lose sleep, at least to wake up in the morning thinking about some of these issues. And I wondered if you had been reading Williams, because you raised the question here about how, I think, you could bear somebody else's burden. There's a delightful exchange here. This is a strange book. It's really not a bad one, Descent into Hell. And has some profound spiritual insights that are religious, and more about heaven than they are about hell. But there is a young woman here who has a strange fear. And of course, it's helpful as a fiction writer to put something out that isn't going to strike very many people directly. And I don't think this strikes very many people here directly. She has been seeing herself coming. She has a doppelganger, and she doesn't have a twin. And she is terrified by this, and she doesn't know what will happen someday. Instead of this just evaporating, she is probably going to meet herself coming. And it's going to be more than just going to the crazy house at the fair and seeing yourself in a mirror. And this... She has been very reluctant to talk to about anybody. And she has found that on the rare occasion when she's mentioned that people haven't been able to understand it. Now, let's see here, if I can get in. Well, in the first place, she has talked to her old grandmother, and she's used a phrase, and I think that comes in as something from E. Stanley Jones' experience. It goes back a long way, and my memory gets cluttered there, but it seems to me it was in India, and there was a great preaching mission with people not provided with captain's chairs or folding chairs. They're awfully cool when you first sit down on them. But sitting on the ground and hearing a long address, and one woman just getting very, very ill at ease, you know, and very tired of sitting up, you know, and being embarrassed. And a lady next to her said, lean on me, it'll be easier. So gratefully, this woman accepted, but typically didn't want to be a real nuisance. And the classic line that this lean on woman passed out was, if you love me, lean hard. I think there's something of that here in Williams when Pauline speaks to her grandmother, and the grandmother says, Pauline, my child, why don't you learn to lean? Well, she still hasn't talked to anybody about this vision that she has, but there is a poet who has a kind of mystical view of the world, very akin to Williams. After all, Williams created him, so he gave him this. And he sort of imposes on Pauline and says, you've got a problem. Why don't you tell me about it? No, she has no problem. She says, well, I'm sure you do. Why don't you tell it to me? And the strange thing here is that she's had just some minor contact with him, and he's a well-known poet, and she is rather fearful, certainly, impoverished orphan. Why should he pay attention to her? But he presses her. And she said, well, I have this recurring experience of my double coming to meet me. And he said, and this is probably a good tactic too. He says, well, that's happened. It happened to Goethe, according to the report, the great German poet. You're not absolutely mad. But still, what's to be done about it? And ultimately, he says, now it's the fear that's really distressing you. I can take your fear for you. Huh? Run that through again. I can take your fear for you. And that sort of thing, I think, stops us. And I did put down somewhere here a way of, you know, if you're a decent teacher, you should be able to raise a question properly. Because I want to push this a little bit more in the few minutes we have left here. Well, how could he take her fear? Can we think of concrete instances where we have had a fear and somebody has lifted it from us? Or an anxiety? Does this work, in other words, practically? Have we experienced it? Can we see it as a possibility and one that will make the world better for somebody? Are you a teacher? Oh. Well, she's speaking about inspiring confidence, and that's one of the things that a good teacher does.
It could also be a management technique, inspire confidence in
pardon?
Employees. I mean, that also be the same as a management technique. The supervisor takes away the burden of the supervisee by saying, look, I'll help you on this, I'll guide you. You're doing just fine. This type of thing. It'd be a teaching tool, management tool, and in a sense, maybe accepting some of the burden.
Yeah. I don't want to push the management too far, and I don't think you are either. There's manipulative management here, too. You know, manipulating people, which I think would be foreign here. Don't you agree? Where you're just saying, okay, I'll help this person so I get more work. But you're right. Being helpful. I have made the announcement before. Yesterday afternoon, my wife and I each made a kite with Jack and his wife to help. Well, Jack was there. When his wife came over, he said, this is my table, go over there. I have never in my life before made a kite that would fly, particularly the first time. But it was all very exact. Jack would say, well, let's see, that piece of crepe paper there, that's just about exactly precisely long enough. It's about so long. So we put it there and the thing flew. But he was there. Say, this is what you do. That's coming along fine. Now you do this. I'm a kite maker. Reinforcement they talk about in school. Reinforcing children. Encouraging them. Tutoring and saying, well done. And this is not anti-Christian. Not just something to be heard at the last trump, well done, thou good and faithful servant. But something that we can give to others. And some people need it badly. Some of you probably saw Richard's slideshow this forenoon. Remember that one girl that he attracted to? She looked so sort of dull. And he sketched her, and he found out what was the Latin word wasn't it? Mm-hmm. For, what is it?
Pretty girl.
And she crossed it out.
Well, she crossed out the pretty.
And then he wrote beautiful. And she took that and clutched it. I thought that was a marvelous picture. That's reinforcement. She seemed so dulled, as if no one had ever said anything to her. Now, I don't think that Hollywood producers should go around all the time and say to every woman in the land that, you know, you're beautiful. They got too many people who already are sure of that and just waiting for the producer to come. But God knows. Who was the old comedian, Will Rogers? We're talking about, you know, being dated. Okay, here I'm dated. Will Rogers said, I never met a man I didn't like. But somehow, the idea creeps in that in the kingdom of God, we are all supposed to go around with a micrometer measuring the spirituality and the holiness of every other person. In the process, we all begin to feel that we are certainly exactly what is described in part of a psalm, worms and no men. Except that the psalm goes on to say we are created a little lower than the angels. That's the part we don't hear. And just one more reference here. They want us to come. Auden said, I had some contacts with his name, Charles Williams. And he said, when you were in his presence, he always made you feel that you were better than you yourself thought. So he was practicing what he preached. Well, it won't hurt us to think some more about this. Oh, I announced that I was going to start with Dag Hammarskjöld. All right, I'm starting Dag Hammarskjöld because there is one line in Hammarskjöld and I have difficulty finding it because I have a different translation now than I had before. And Hammarskjöld uses the word coherence, and there, my friends, is the connection. We better get to church.